This is independent librarian dynamic, Sean Kennedy the Sixth, doing a pirate broadcast of episode number 732.653.663.398.36.15. This is a broadcast in Queen's English from some time after now. I'm broadcasting from the future so that the past doesn't necessarily have to come to be. I'm broadcasting so that you have a chance to stop what's coming. But by listening to my broadcast, you should be aware that you're violating your listener's license, and you may be violating your creativity permits. And in so doing so, well, could be subject to termination or enforced recycling. I thought of something the other day, too. The fact that you listened to this may, well, it may affect you in the future because, well, it could be considered to be terrorist activity in the past, records, what you've heard or what you've read. Who's to say that people who know that you've listened to this won't declare you a risk, just like people who've read certain books could be considered a risk. That's if you find some books. But to those of you in the past, the only advice I could give you is to make sure that you may want to listen to this in private so that you don't wind up getting a whole bunch of people charged, and don't let other people know. But in your own way, you can fight it. You can fight what's coming just by circulating things, circulating information. Make people know, and with knowledge will come strength. If you're the kind of person who would turn this broadcast off, you need it more than anyone. If this should shock you or disturb you, you should listen because you need it most. And so by server's grace, light your candles, and server will protect us. I'm not really one to be talking about protection. I mean, for all intents and purposes, I've quite probably gone mad. Since I was a new Roman, since Mr. Weaver put these components in my head, I didn't really know what to expect. When I left New Rome, there was that humming, that buzzing sound, which was coming from inside my mind, but that was nothing compared to what was going to be coming. I ran for days. I didn't even stop during the daytime, which wasn't that great. Heat was unbearable, but thanks to the coat, kept me going. I had to put distance between me and New Rome. I didn't know what would happen. I mean, Weaver, being a dread man, I don't know if he might change his mind. Maybe I ran to get away. I ran to put distance between me and what I'd become. Maybe I was trying to run away from myself, I don't really know, but I ran, I'll tell you that. My recon helmet picked up a wreckage out in the... Well, we moved further and further away from New Rome, and the wastelands got more and more desert. You gotta understand that out here, sometimes I take things for granted, you know, I think you know what I'm talking about, but after the ozone layer got burned off, most of America, what was America, became like a desert at the best of times. There's not a lot of trees. Most of the trees are gone, and they've been stripped away for lumber and resources and that. So the trees that do exist, there are forests. They do still exist, but, I mean, they're usually located around many bodies of water that are still moving, and the animals that are there, so I've heard, take shelter in the shade and the thick canopy. We still have animals. They're just not nearly as plentiful. About 90% of them have died off. That doesn't count insects and other creatures that are able to exist at night, but once you take out one part of the equation, the food chain falls apart pretty fast. So the deserts out here are like, I'm trying to find something you can imagine. You ever see like a beach where they've got like dead grass and scrub? That's kind of what the whole most of America is like. Sometimes it's just sand with ripples on it, shaped by the wind that goes on for miles and miles. I mean, it's amazing to see in a terribly beautiful way when the sun comes up over across America and there's these desert dunes and the sky turns violent, violent shades of orange and purple and violet and blue and green. Like they say, you know, nature never knew colors like that. It took us with all of our pollution and various amounts of toxins. God only knows how much industry is still putting up into the sky. There's a movement a few years back where they were talking about how the pollution being put in the atmosphere was actually going to take the place of the ozone layer. Trying to make people feel better about, since we lost the ozone layer, we'll create a shield ourselves with pollution, you know, because that'll act as an ozone layer. It's not man-made, or it's not natural, you know, it's man-made, but it's the next best thing. Shield yourself with chemical waste. Unbelievable. But it comes to be. People used to think that their bodies were temples, when in actuality it's the planet that was the temple. That's where we all live, and nobody paid any attention. So never mind anything else that I tell you. Never mind any other information that I happen to pass on to you. You might want to, I don't know, think about recycling other than, you know, body parts. Apparently in the past, people had the choice of whether or not to put, you know, cans or bottles inside of recycling containers. Now, I mean, now people recycle their parents. You know, they gut rip roadkill. I mean, anything that can be recycled for the act of profit, I mean, it'll be done. That's all on the fringes, though, and I'm a long way from the fringes right now. Where was I? Oh, yeah. I've been running for quite some time. I think it was about 3 days. Helmet tells me 3 days. And I saw some wreckage showed up. Had a metal bounce back from the in-helmet sonar. So I veered path and tore over to it. It was coming up on morning on the, I guess it would have been the fourth day. So it would have been 3 days and three nights. The helmet came up and I've been able to put some good speed. I mean, you can get some good distance if you run nonstop like that. And plus with these reconnaissance legs, this is the first real time I put a test on them. They're quite the equipment. The metal bounce pack was a down plane. It was an aircraft, transport craft. Skies used to be full of these things. You know, there's all these aircraft that fly here and fly there. And back when we still had time before everything got copywritten, they used to report these plane crashes. You know, they used to, you know, there'd be passengers, right? And there'd be like 200 dead or 300 dead. Or if there was, you know, eventually, you know, they had smaller passenger planes, but they stopped reporting the smaller passenger planes. You know, it was always, eventually you never heard about the two-seater or the three-seater or the 10 people that got killed. You only ever heard about the, you know, 200s and 300s. And people thought maybe the two-seaters weren't crashing anymore because they didn't hear about it, so I guess it wasn't happening. Well, of course it was happening. And then there was the supply planes. everyone has concerns about passenger craft because, well, it's, again, it all came down to profit. Came down to money. If a passenger plane goes down and 300 people are killed, very high odds that somebody's going to sue you. They use the legal weaponry to take out your business. But if it's a transport craft, it's just supplies on board. You stand the risk of losing some things in transit. During the time of the crisis and during the war, they stopped even reporting transport craft falling out of the sky. And the government being so involved, they stopped looking at the maintenance and everything that was done on transport craft. They paid attention to the passenger, but a lot of the transport pilots, they're flying just things held together by a shoestring. It was just unbelievable how they just flew these hunks of junk. It was cheaper to get used planes, fly them until they died, rather than to, you know, try to maintain them because parts were expensive. I mean, simple maintenance you could do, but not major overhauls. It makes sense in a twisted kind of way if you think about it. So, during the time of the wars, with all the rioting and everything that was happening, no one wanted to transport anything by truck, and if you couldn't afford to put anything on trains, well, you flew it there. And these planes were falling out of the sky. Lost a lot of them. And when you're out here in the wastelands, you can still find them, and that's what this one was. This was some kind of a transport craft. I got over there. It's about the size of it looked like an old Hercules aircraft. They used to use them as army planes. Pretty big, I suppose. I mean, it thundered in pretty hard. One of the wings was completely gone. The other one was sort of sticking up like a kind of like a strange fish that had turned on its side and stuck this wing out over the desert, giving a shelf, like this rock outcropping kind of thing. It was all swept with sand. Half the wing had cracked off, so it created kind of a ledge. But it was far enough, high enough off the ground that you could sit under it, and one of the doors was exposed, so I waited for about half an hour looking for signs of life. The recon scan on the helmet showed me there was nothing alive in there whatsoever. There's no power source. This had been out here a long time. So very carefully I closed the gap and got in there. Sitting in the cockpit was, I called him Frank. Frank was the pilot. He was beach bone white. Absolutely desiccated. It was funny, actually. It was like something out of a movie, you know? There was absolutely no flesh left on this person. Not desiccated, not dried or nothing. It was like somebody had taken a Hollywood skeleton and put it in the put it in the pilot seat. Like a medical skeleton, almost. Even his helmet was still on. With most of the animals. So by seeing that, of course, you can pretty much tell that this had gone down after we lost the ozone, because the insects were the things that cleaned them out. And the insects will strip away every single part of, you know, your anything fleshy that can be taken by the insects was. So they took all his hair, they took everything. One of his arms had fallen off, but it was held together by his flight suit. There was other chairs littered around the back, storage chairs, so I dragged one out of the wreckage. There's nothing useful inside. I mean, everything in there was just dried up. I think he was flying electronic parts at one time or another, but there was no batteries. There was nothing there. I kicked open a few crates, but I was too tired. So I came outside and set one of the flight chairs up underneath the wing. Like, this thing became my very own little home for a few hours. The way I was able to keep running nonstop like that was thanks once again to the recon helmet. With the military's invention of, well, with the legalization of aggression drugs and things like that, the aggression drugs became more and more and more potent. They became really, really concentrated, so that all you had to do was put a drop of stuff on your skin, and, I mean, if you put too much on, it would kill you. So when they built these recon helmets, they knew the guys would have to stay alive for a long time, so they actually, as part of the shooters, which is, I mentioned this before, but a shooter is a chemical enhancement that they do in case you run into nerve toxins or whatever. But they actually are able to put in these microneedles that will just administer like 0.003 of a milligram of these stay awake and aggression drugs, and it's enough to keep you going. And there's enough in this helmet to keep me awake and moving forwards for, like, without sleep whatsoever. I mean, my body would probably give out on me, but there's enough for several thousand dosages, 10,000-20,000 dosages. So, I mean, it's not like I'm going to run out. If I made a decision to keep running, this helmet would have kept dosing me. I figured this out as I sat underneath the wing, and I realized that I wasn't tired. I had to wait for the crash. I had to wait for it to wear off. So I took the helmet off because I was worried that maybe it might decide to just keep me awake. I gotten good at taking the helmet off. It's a bit of a trick to get the sucker off, but it did come off. So I took the helmet off, and that buzzing came back. And that's when I realized what it was that they had done to me, what it was to be a Dread Man. You see, being a Dread Man was, well, everyone's afraid of them because they know that they can see electronics. They know that they can see what's going through the air, but it's hard to try to imagine, and it's even harder for me to try to describe to you what that's like. The only way I can do it is by explaining to you that your eyes, I mean, no one explains how to see. How do you explain sight to a blind man? It doesn't happen. Your eyes, light comes down, hits an object, enters in through the lens of your eye, broadcasts a picture on the back of your eye. Those signals are then taken by the optic nerve into your brain, and your brain then takes these signals and transforms them into an image. Dreadman hardware, which is, well, experimental and probably one of the greatest achievements in a horrible way for all of mankind, was that it would interface with the optic nerve and add the ability, like a radio scanner, to pick up any kind of radio frequency and interpret it. Any kind of frequency, depending on the scanner that they put in. Some Dread Men were only made to hear certain frequencies, or military Dread Men, or whatever. But I'd gotten the good stuff. I had a good implant that did a pretty wide range of stuff. Being a librarian, I imagine that was Mr. Weaver's goal. It's funny, between Prophet altering my body cybernetically and Weaver, well, I suppose it could be said, altered my body spiritually. Didn't know who I was, and everyone wants to keep me alive because I'm a librarian. Given the choice, I don't know if I'd keep living. But I'm here, and I wanted a new start, and I guess that's what I have. Anyway, getting back to what I see, I took off the helmet, and I looked out over the desert. Now, luckily, because I'm this far out in the wasteland, there's not a lot of radio frequencies. There's a lot of distant noise that can be heard up in the stratosphere, and you can look up there, and if you strain yourself, it's like hearing, oh, like a party or something happening down the block. You'll hear echoes and voices, and sometimes they well up around you. And maybe they're conversations that are happening or radio traffic. It's like if you tuned in, you'd hear it. This strange mixture of signal traffic. Everything traveling through the air. If I was in a city, I probably would have gone mad. It would be too much. There'd be too much traffic. Cellular conversations, digital mediums, instant messaging. Everything's wireless. I can understand why the Dreadmen would want to avoid the inner city. Even the Megas. I mean, even the Fringes. There's always, you know, pirate radio stations and everything that would come to pass. But more than hearing it, at distance, you see things as well. Sometimes I'll see strange shapes, creatures, things that might look like angels or even like... How do you explain a shapeless thing to someone? How do you explain how your brain takes a radio signal and makes it into a creature? I looked around inside of the downed craft, and thankfully all the electronics were gone, but you can see echoes like skeletons. You begin to see digital echoes. Signatures left so subtly that you wouldn't even pick it up. But with your mind, you're able to combine what you see with what you hear, the knowledge you have in the past, and it all combines together to make pictures inside of yourself. Sometimes radio equipment seems to stand out as though it's painted in neon. It doesn't do anything, but you can see it more easily. Like if you were to take something that had been broadcasting and had that slight resonance signal on it, a Dreadman would be able to line up 6 capacitors and know which ones were used and which ones weren't, or circuitry. I suppose in a way it'd be good to know if your equipment you're buying is new or not. So I sat underneath the wing of the plane for a while and just watched the colors in the stratosphere and watched the traveling. It's kind of like watching clouds, but seeing shapes. I was waiting for the stay-awake drugs that had been pumped in my system to just sort of fade out. Wanted them to wear off so I could try to get some sleep. As I sat, I couldn't help but think about what Weaver had said to me. Talking about looking for X. I mean, what is X? I don't know what X is. I went in there trying to discover who I am, and he winds up shoving a bunch of hardware into my mind and telling me I'm on a quest to go find X. And I didn't know what X could mean. I mean, what does that mean, you know? I was so far away from any kind of communication or medium. You gotta understand, like, when I got out of the rack there, I was able to download my ghost. I didn't talk much about that. All of your memories and essential data can be shadowed now to hardware. I can't really get too into it because I don't understand it all myself, but essentially what happens is that if you've got a set of memories or knowledge or information that you wish to have hard-coded, if you've got the implants so you can read hard-coded data, you can download that information so you can remember certain things. This became very popular after they figured out that life extension had a very strong opportunity to destroy memories and things like that. It was an expensive process, but of course, like everything else, it became somewhat commonplace. So, when I got out of the camp, it's easy to download information, to reach out over a very, you know, low bandwidth radio signal and download this data, which I was able to do. But actually searching things out over the web, I mean, the web interface now is so involved, especially if you're using eyes or you've got the hardware that I have. I mean, it's a major bandwidth thing, you know, out here in the sticks out here, well, past the sticks, you should say. It's very, very difficult. So you need to have a solid connection. You need to have a serious, you know, antenna. And that's not something that I had. I mean, I could... This isn't something you can jerry-rig, you know. I mean, I could probably... If I had some working parts like a radio, I could make it happen, but you can't just make it out of scrap. You know, you got to have some basic components. It's about every kid knows how to build a directional antenna so you could point it at a city to get online. It's like, you know, kids used to know how to carve wood or go fishing. Now we know how to make sure we have a solid network connection. So, but, I mean, all the, everything in this plane was rotted out. I had nothing to even build the antenna out of. So it was a bit of a go. And for that matter, I had no idea how far it would have to reach. I know I was a long ways away from, well, from anything. I mean, if you're only a few miles out from the city, you know, you can pretty much build it out of a piece of pipe. But the kind of distance I'm talking, it's a bit too far to try to fake it. You know what I mean? So, if I had a network connection, if I could get on the web, I could try to do some research, try to figure out where this, you know, this Kingdom of Nod is. Where the hell is Kingdom of Nod? I know that biblically it had something to do with Cain and Abel. Cain and Abel were these brothers, and one brother killed the other brother, and I guess God got all ticked off about it and put a mark on him and sent him out into the king, into the land of Nod. So I don't know what that meant. Like, am I supposed to go find Cain? Is that who, what X is? Is an X a who or a what? I had no idea. And I'm sitting there just trying to figure this out. You know, I'm reaching out and amongst the radio traffic, and I tried to listen in. Maybe I could pick up something, because I mean, I don't have much experience doing this whole Dreadman thing. So I just sort of was trying to focus on what direction should to go. I mean, I didn't even know where I'm supposed to go from here. I briefly entertained the notion of just setting up camp here in this burned out plane. This chair is pretty comfortable, I'll tell you that. And since, well, with the legs and everything, sitting outside, I could just stretch it out. I felt like it was this weird trailer park. I'm the only resident. So I sat there, staring out into the heat waves and listening to the radio traffic. And in the heat of the desert, the sun, it was about midday. I spent the whole morning just sort of watching the radio traffic in the distance. Middle of the day, throughout the heat, I saw something coming right out of the rippling waves off the heat of the desert. There was a dark shape that was coming. Immediately, I grabbed my helmet and slapped it back on my head so I could get a range finding on it. I didn't know what it was, and that's a cause for some alarm when things like that happen. So I threw the helmet on, and it wasn't there. The helmet didn't pick up anything. There was nothing there. The radio traffic stopped, and there was this eerie silence. I mean, I'd gotten so used to hearing the traffic that putting the helmet on, it was like someone turned the music off. It was just bizarre. Turn on the telescopics and change the visual away from white to black, black to white, looking for anything in range, throwing out sonar signals, everything, but there was nothing in the distance. There was nothing there. So I took the helmet back off again, and there, standing maybe 200 feet away, large of life, was this thing standing. Like, there's no way that the helmet wouldn't have seen it. I mean, there's rumors of stealth technology and stuff, but not like this. This was some sort of, I mean, it was a figment of my imagination, a radio wave, a signal. I didn't know what it was. It was standing there. To describe this thing to you is, you really think I've gone mad, but you'd have to imagine. I'm sitting underneath the wing of this plane, and I'm looking out across the burning, really burning sand now, with the sun down on it, and it cast a shadow on everything. And standing about 200 feet away from me was this tall figure. It wasn't a man. It was this bizarre collaboration of man and machine. It was bipedal. It looked like a human. It looked like actually a one of the camp victims. It was tall, maybe 6 feet, maybe even taller than that, maybe close to 7 feet. Very, very skinny, like a human. It was a human skeleton, you know what I mean? But it had flesh strapped over it, like it was an emaciated corpse, like you see in death camp pictures. This bone rack, but tall, His skin was gray, sickly gray. Shadows where muscles used to be. And instead of a head, it had a television instead of a head. So if you could imagine this as bone rack victim leading up to, instead of his neck came up and it just merged perfectly with this television set. And there's two rabbit ears. I knew it was a television set because of the rabbit ears, you know. I could, at the very top, there was these two, like, antennas. They used to call them rabbit ears, sticking out. And one of them was extended. The other one, you know, at about a 45 degree. And the other one was sort of came out at a similar degree, but it was snapped in the middle and sort of bent down. And he was just standing there. And there was static on the television screen. Like, the television screen was actually getting, you know, signal. Well, I didn't know what to do. I'm standing there staring at this thing, and I'm guessing that it must be some sort of a interpretation from the Dreadman hardware that's been put into my head. This is some kind of a radio signal or some sort of a signal that's shown up. I mean, there was nothing else for me to do. All I could do was stare. I didn't know what to do. I mean, what do you do when you're presented with something like that? I've seen a lot of strange things, a lot of different mutants, but there's no way. I've never seen anything mutate into a television set. And it would have showed up. I mean, it didn't show up on the helmet, so I tried not to get too excited. I just sort of, you know, thought about what it could possibly be or what it could mean. It didn't look dangerous. It didn't have any weapons. So I just waited. And once it began to calm down a little bit, it took a step closer. It was connected to me somehow. I didn't know how, but it knew when I was nervous and when I wasn't nervous. It was all on cue. It just started walking towards me. I didn't get up from the chair. I just sat the helmet down beside me and kept staring at it. It came closer and closer until eventually it was underneath the wing as well, and it squatted down on its legs, not quite letting itself touch the ground, but it just sat there, sort of squatted like the way a dog would sit. The static of the television screen was in front of me. And it's funny, you know, with that screen, it kind of drew your attention to it. And I looked down on his arm. He had numbers. It looked like they were tattooed. But the bones in his arms, like, the skin was actually separated between his two, his radius and his ulna, both of the bones and of his arm. He was, you know, humor, whatever it's called. It was, the skin had actually dried there, but I could still see the numbers written on there, and the numbers were, it was T26350333, and every three digits it was separated by a dash. And I thought to myself, you know, what is this? What is this thing? You know? So I opened my mouth and I said, "Who are you?" And the static on the screen disappeared for just a second, and it was black. And then these big letters came across like all in white, like you couldn't miss them. It was just huge. All it was, the whole, each letter filled the screen. The letters were I, C, U, and then another U, and then a B, and an I. And then the screen went black again. But it didn't go back to static, it just went back to the darkness of the screen. And I repeated the question. I said, "Who are you?" And the letters came up again. I-C-U-U-B-I. So I sort of sounded it out, and I said, "Ikubi." And it nodded, which was handy, which means that by nodding, it would give me a yes or no answer, because there was no mouth. It was just a television set, you know? And I said, "What are you doing here?" And right when he said that, the screen flashed to memories, my memories, things that I knew in my past. I saw myself walking, well, as though it was my own eyes, you know, walking through the wastelands. I saw myself running. And then I, watching the screen, the images merged, and it began looking, I began to see things I would only imagine. You know when you imagine something really, really clearly and you can see it in your mind like a dream? That's what I was looking at, but I could see it, like, really, really clearly. And it was amazing to watch. I was staring into the face of this Indu Akubi, and I could see it. And I watched a series of memories go by, and it was an amazing thing to see. Being able to see things again. Some of the picture was kind of fuzzy. It wasn't crystal clear. The more distant the memory, the more fuzzy the picture, but I could hear things, and this wave of realization going through me, these memories that I had, and I realized that this thing, Akubi, was me. Well, it was not really me. It was like my memories externalized. It was the way that, with the new Dreadman hardware in my body, that this being was created from my memories. This concentration camp body with a television set for a mind. And strangely appropriate, really. I mean, when you think about it, for years we were all just manipulated. We were all raised, growing gaunt, forgetting to eat, staring at the cathode rays that came from the all-seeing eye that we all put in our living rooms. Gave us the news, gave us the weather, told us everything, all from this box. I mean, everything we thought, it shaped how we thought, it shaped it how we acted. It only made sense that it would shape how we looked, too, and from a certain standpoint. That's what the television set was. Akubi, I see you, UBI. It was me. Well, you are what you watch. And so, with the numbers and his concentration camp form and that television set, this was my own representation to myself. Sitting here with the helmet off and getting all introspective and thinking about what I was doing and where I was going, I conjured him. This digital totem to come and speak to me, to come talk to me, to explain to me what I needed to hear, I guess. In any case, he wasn't here to hurt me, which was a kind of a positive thing. I was rather pleased about that. But watching these memories, it was addictive. I did that for hours, just sitting there underneath the wing of a burned-out plane, staring at this digital totem, staring at Akubi, and watching my life on his flash before me on a screen. It's funny how things you know, things you see every day, somehow look better when they're on a television screen. I remember people used to get all excited when they found out they were going to be on TV, as though being on the television elevated them in status somehow. You know, look at me, I'm on TV. You know, here I am at the temple. I'm in the temple. So many people can see me because I'm on TV. Makes us more real somehow. As the sun lowered itself, I began to think more about matters at hand. Maybe Akubi could help me. Maybe he could figure it out. And I said to him, I said, do you know anything about the Kingdom of Nod? And all that I got was just more flashes and memories of biblical passages, and I saw Cain kill Abel on the screen. Nothing I didn't already know. I thought to myself, well, you know, because it's, he only had memories that I had. So I said, how am I gonna find out where I'm supposed to go here, Akubi? How am I supposed to do that? But then the screen changed. The minute I asked that, the screen changed, and I was watching news reports, and there was sound. It came over the crackled speakers, too. And it was a news report from years ago that I must have seen. got lost somewhere in my subconscious mind, but it was a news report about how the media, during the listener's license, when the listener's license came into being, of course, they had to crack down on all recorded media. And you can't create a crackdown like that when all broadcast media and recording media is regulated. You can't crack down like that without there being a severe backlash, and people would fight back. And what wound up happening was there were these ham radio and pirate radio broadcasters, mostly ham radio and shortwave, who went out into the desert, into remote locations, and they set up broadcast stations where they would broadcast for free. So everyone went out and bought shortwave radio so they could have unfiltered knowledge, and they had it there. And they would broadcast this knowledge all over the world. Anything they wanted to say, they broadcast music, unregulated art, they broadcast books. Of course, this was all highly, highly illegal, but there was a number of them that happened, and they all kept their locations secret. Some of them, in the early days, could broadcast 24 hours, but eventually, as the crackdown came, the corporations wound up sending out the police. It was nothing more than a hired muscle, really. Shut them down. They began to broadcast at irregular times. The rumors were circulated through the web and through encrypted knowledge. People would, you know, let them know when the broadcast was going to happen, and then the way they'd track them, they'd have mirrors on different antennas, and they'd set up. It was really quite an ordeal. But the news report was about that. It was all about this, you know, these terrorists who were taking over the airwaves without licensing, you know. Of course, they found the most extreme versions of that. You know, whenever they want to shut something down that's free, they always find the most extreme versions. You know, they find the white supremacists or the people who cater to child pornography or things like that. They never talk about the people who are giving real news or information or teaching people or reading out, you know, William Shakespeare over the airwaves. They never look at those guys. No, they always look to find the most sensational, horrible thing they can. And that's what this news report was. And it hit me like a wave of knowledge. The beauty of the bod of it. And I realized, I said, why am I... There must be a spike out here. Spikes were what they called, it's a slang term for after after all the broadcasting media became illegal, they called them spikes. Antennas. Huge radio station antennas that they'd build out of, well, they'd buy the antenna packs and they'd build them out here, and they'd have like a spike base one, spike base two, that kind of a thing. So these guys would go to here and build a spike. There must be a spike nearby, otherwise why would Ikubi tell me that? And I realized that if I was to try to look for one, how would I find it? And everyone who's ever thrown signal knows that there's more, like radio waves are easier to travel at night than it is during the day. So I realized that at night, once the sun set, I might be able to pick up on the signal. I might be able to find one of these spikes if there's something that might still be broadcasting, some sort of remote signal or even anything, something I could catch up on. As I sat there, the thoughts I was thinking about finding a spike, about discovering where one could be, like flashed through a Kubi screen, and I could see why he came. This was my higher mind, I guess is what they'd say in some New Age circles. He came out to the desert to help me. So we sat. And as I began to think and consider this, his screen turned back to static. But it wasn't black and white static normally. It was like red and yellow and white and darker colors. And it was the color of fire. If you can imagine fire as static, that's what was flashing on my face. It's like having a fire out there as the sun set. When the sun sets, there's less interference in the atmosphere. It has to do with the solar layers or layers of signal, so that the signal would go more. So I figured that if I was going to try to make this, if I was going to try to find one of these spikes, I should probably get on top of the plane, get myself in an area, get as high as I can so I could probably pick up the signal. I looked up and Ikubi was gone, just like that, poof, he was vanished. Well, he was never really there to start with. But I guess since I had a plan, since I knew what I was doing, he wasn't really needed anymore, so he just kind of dissolved. I didn't see him go. It was just, I became aware he was gone. So I got up out of the chair, and with a quick hop, thanks to my legs, I was able to land on top of the burned-out hulk of the Hercules. And I crawled up on the tip of the wing. The claws bit deep into the decaying remnants of the metal. I got to the highest point I could, which was just on the edge of the busted wing. I was worried about the weight, but it seemed to hold okay. So I hooked on and looked out across, well, across the desert as the sun set. And the noise and the traffic was there. Got a little louder, but gradually I tried to focus on the sound. I tried to focus on the one thing I could hear. So that I could... I don't even know what I was listening for. I was listening for a signal that came from one of these spikes. So it's like trying to hear a friend's voice that you don't know in a crowd full of people who are talking. Very, very difficult to do. Very, very difficult. As I strained, it became quiet. I forced my mind to filter out the other radio waves. I forced myself to try to open myself up to hear a radio signal, maybe some transponder noise from one of these spikes. It got dark, really dark. There was no moon. And I could see, floating through like the northern lights in the atmosphere, the radio traffic. Some had picked up and was streaking so high above me, you had to focus to see it. And it was like comets flying back and forth. Knowledge, information, these burning bright lights in the darkness of the sky. And then, from not too far away, I heard this chirp, and there was a flash of light. And it was a radio signal. It was a transponder signal, some noise put out. I couldn't tell you exactly what it was, but it was something that was coming from a spike. That's why, I guess I must have heard it during the day, because that's why Akubi knew about it. And it was coming from a direction. It flew out like this fairy, like a pixie. It drifted out and it came straight to me and flew around me like you'd imagine a moth would move. So as quick as I could, I jumped down off the Herc and I grabbed my helmet, made sure I had all my stuff, and I headed out chasing after it. And as fast as my mechanical legs could pump, that's how fast the little bright light would bury in front of me and go. It just kind of swerved back and forth. And as I ran, it got a little brighter, so I could tell that I must be getting closer to the signal. I must be, in fact, getting stronger. And it felt exhilarating. I was like a bloodhound on radio noise. I was following this signal, this electronic data that was floating about me, all because of that Dreadman hardware that he put in my head. And for the first time, I felt like Mr. Weaver had actually done me a favor by giving me this. By installing that hardware, I was able to see Akubi. I was able to know my own mind better. Being a librarian, there's so many memories I have, so much knowledge that Akubi could display on his screen to me. And I ran, chasing after this bright light. It was incredible. I ran for the better part of the night. Gone were any thoughts of being tired. I left the helmet off and just moved with it. Allowed myself to be lost in the radio freedom of the night. The night really is the time for any kind of traffic. That's the best time to be sending signal. That's the best time for any broadcast. The nighttime is the best time. Which is true when you think about it. I mean, how many different people exist at night that don't exist during the day? Some people say that darkness is a bad thing. I don't think it is. I think light is extremely judgmental. Passes judgment, reveals all these things, but for those of us that are too weak to protect ourselves from the savagery of the light, the nighttime folds around us and gives us shelter when there is none other. People talk about Mother Night, and it's so true. Shielding and protecting us from all those hideous revelations that come during the day. At night, people are more at ease. They feel better. just the strain is not there. There's not so much stress at night as there is during the daytime. There's more freedom. Maybe it's because you're more anonymous because of lack of light. I don't know. But as I thundered through the desert, my legs pumping, all these thoughts came through me as I stayed focused on the changing light of my guide, this little fairy. I crested over a hill, and there before me was a broken tower. There was a spike out here. A radio spike was out here in the middle of nowhere, and Akubi knew it. He knew it. I guess I knew it. Maybe there's something to this gut response. I stood there, amazed, and the light flew back in and flew into the tower as though it was his hive. The tower had snapped off due to wind, but it was easily repairable. It had faltered at one of the joints I could see from here. And I was just amazed. I was probably more amazed that it was actually here, that I was actually looking at it. It was incredible. There was a little shack, not too big. Had some, like, car hoods and car parts. Some old skulls and bones that had been glued to it or nailed to it for decoration. It's just a hovel, really, a real hole. I don't think anyone ever lived there. I think it was just there for a broadcast site. There's some writing on the wall, but the sand and the wind and the sun had burned it off. Don't know what it had said. It was probably the call sign to whatever station, whatever pirate station this was. And I was amazed. I was amazed that this thing was here. Akubi was right. There was a spike out here. And so I crawled down. I was a lot less careful than I should have been. Realistically, I should have scoped in on this thing for a couple of hours before I closed with it, but I didn't. I guess I was caught up in the moment. Not too smart. But as it stands, there was nothing there. I went down. There was a rusted lock on the door, which meant that there was no one inside. There's no way that you could replace this lock. I did a quick lap around to see there was no other entrance. There was just one door. Grabbed hold of the lock, and I just put a little bit of pressure on it. The lock just came apart in my hands. Rain, rust, and rot had done its damage to all the metal workings. And I went inside. And that's where I am right now. I'm sitting inside of a little shack, looking at a whole bunch of dusty, dirty radio equipment. A set of burned out headphones. A chair that's here is cracked leather. I think when I sat down it split a seam, but I don't really mind so much. Luckily it's on wheels, so I can find room to get my legs to stretch out. And so this is where I'm at right now, and that's how I got here. It's thanks to Akubi and following the light in my mind and my newfound skills. So I figure, I don't know what's going to happen when I try to go online. I don't know what's going to happen when I try to jack into the web with all my additional hardware that's been put in. So I figured I'd do another broadcast before I got underway with setting this place up. Now sitting here calmly without my helmet on, I'm feeling pretty tired. I'll probably get some sleep, and then tomorrow I'll try to repair this tower and get online, see if I can get any more data about X and about the Kingdom of Nod. Gotta keep you informed. Gotta keep you up to date, I guess, on what's happening. Well, I guess that's pretty much it for me right now. This is Independent Librarian Dynamic, Sean Kennedy VI. Doing a pirate broadcast of episode number 732.653.663.398.36.15 in Queen's English from sometime after now. Thanks for listening. Thanks for caring about this. I don't know what the future will hold for me. I don't even know if I'm going to make it through doing another hook in online. I don't think I've ever seen a Dreadman online, so I don't know if it'll kill me or what. But for some reason, it doesn't bother me. somehow I feel like no matter what, that's all borrowed time and I should just be happy to exist right now. My future's uncertain, but your future isn't. If you're listening to this in the past, there's things happening every day around you, all day, that forces are vying for your attention. Forces are trying to manipulate you into creating this world. Because you're going to create this world. There are no financial forces or political forces that are going to create this. It's the everyday person that does. So if you hear this, you want to stop this from happening, you can, just by making little decisions every day. By doing this, you're helping the world, and you're helping me. Please, please help me.
Hi there, this is Sean Kennedy. If you liked this episode of Tales from the Afternow, and you'd like to download the others for free, you can do it at www.theafternow.com. If you'd like to support Tales from the Afternow, you can make a donation there as well. Thank you.